Change is possible. And it's possible even in the darkest hour when you feel like there is no more hope. And you and I are walking living proof of that. Theoretically, we should have had horrible dads. And sure, you and I both talked openly about the reality that we have imperfect dads, and I am an imperfect dad. Like, we should have had horrible dads who had no idea what they were doing. And yet, both of us have fathers who quite literally changed their family tree.
Yes.
And so I would imagine, despite the feelings of hopelessness and despair when they're little kids and they're having these dark moments, whether it was your dad being left alone in the car, not knowing how many hours is going to be stuck there, whether it was my dad getting beat up or watching his mom get beat up, it's kind of miraculous that you and I are here, married to each other, with the kind of kids that we have, living the life that we have, with this level of commitment to each other and a willingness to do the work. Hey, friends. Welcome back to Wow Live a Life podcast. As always, I am Harris III, and I'm joined by my favorite co-host of all time. No offense to any of the other amazing people that I have co-hosted many wonderful things with over the years, but I just call her Babe. Babe.
Babe. I mean, I am your co-host for life.
Our kids make fun of us. They're like, Babe, Babe. Babe. They like mock us for calling each other Babe.
Well, for the longest time, they actually thought that was my name. Well, this is Harris and Babe. And I was like, I'm sorry. I'm not sure you understood the endearing term that your daddy was giving to me. Oh, her name's Babe.
Yes, yes. Welcome, everyone. If this is your first episode, like if this just happens to be your entry point into the podcast, you are listening to an Afterglow episode. So we've been experimenting in this first season of the Wild Level Life podcast with what we think is an interesting format. And it's interesting, a lot of podcasts are either one person talking directly to someone, sharing their ideas. We wanted to be able to do that. A lot of podcasts are interview-based where they get to find these amazing guests from around the world and hear their stories and try to collect some wisdom and expertise. We kind of wanted to do that too. And then Kate and I were just like, we also kind of want to just do a podcast together. We're able to sit down and chat about a variety of topics that we're interested in that we think will awaken your wonder and stir your imagination and try to get you to be a little bit more curious about growth and all the magic that's available to you. And we're like, yeah, let's definitely do that. And so we were talking and we're like, well, why don't we just do it all? But instead of making it super random and just like every episode is just whatever we feel like on that given week, we decided to go deep instead of wide. And so kind of what we do is the first episode in each three-part series is looking at some stories throughout history to inspire us to get curious and ask some questions around a particular theme or topic. And then once we establish that theme or topic, we find a special guest and we interview them and have a conversation with them and try to draw some of the wisdom of their own story out to try to awaken your wonder, make you more curious. And then we have these afterglow episodes where before we just jump on to the next thing, we let that theme and topic continue to linger and Kate and I have a conversation about it. So welcome to the afterglow episode. Over these last couple of weeks, you've heard about everyone from Maya Angelou and the role that her creativity and making of art played in the healing of her trauma. Last week, we got to sit down with Jackie Power, a therapist, an amazing poet, a therapeutic poet, as she yes. sometimes refers to herself as.
A therapeutic poet.
Yeah, to have a conversation around, well, many things, and we'll talk through some of those themes here today. But now, Kate and I are here, and let's continue the conversation about creativity and trauma.
And trauma. You know what? This is going to be a light episode for all of you. We just wanted to keep it real surfacey. No, we don't mess around. We go go big or go home. What's funny is as you were talking, I was thinking to myself, really, we're just recording the conversations we're having anyway.
Yeah.
Which y'all just get to listen in on, which might be borderline ridiculous.
For worse.
For better or for worse. Yeah. Here we are.
But I feel like we should start this conversation with a disclaimer. First of all, I am not a therapist.
Nor am I.
I'm not a licensed mental health practitioner. Kate, you got further than I did. You were at least a psych major in college.
I was, three full years.
Yeah, never went on to finish and go get your master's and get the license. But this is a topic that you and I think, have both been interested in really since almost the early days that we met and were hanging out with each other over 20 years ago. And it has continued to remain a topic of focus. You know, we're going to talk about this phrase, trauma-informed, briefly here in just a few moments. But I like to think that we fit into the healthy category that despite not being licensed therapists, we work really hard to be responsible with our understanding of trauma, the way we talk about trauma, so that a lot of the coaching work and consulting we're doing with teams and individuals, that we have an accurate understanding of trauma and the role that it plays in the process of trying to transform people's lives and the stories that they tell themselves. And so we're going to tread into that lightly with responsibility and respect for many who are far more
experienced
in this area and have an actual thing called a license. The only license I have, I think, is a driver's license. And so my expertise is limited at what I am able to research and study and read. But obviously, trauma is something that we've both experienced.
Yes.
In a variety of ways. Last week's conversation with Jackie also got into addiction and medication of that addiction. Both of us come from families who struggled from addiction in multiple generations. I mean, when it comes to addiction, you could also say that you and I are addicts as well. All of us have a tendency
addicts to something.
And we're always using something to medicate for those unless we're constantly works in progress and trying to pay attention to that. And so it is a topic that we are familiar with, and I'm hoping this can be a vulnerable conversation for us, all with the goal of helping those listening in, that's you guys, yeah, just understand that there is really a role. It's not just because it's called the Wow Level Life podcast. There really is a role that positive awe states, wonder can play in the healing of some of the darker chapters in our story. And beyond that, that we come to an understanding that curiosity, wonder, and action, that it's hard to heal this stuff without getting a little bit more curious about the stories we're telling ourselves. So I want to start with a quote, one of my favorite quotes. By the way, we don't really prepare for these conversations. We literally jump on and start having them.
If you could see my face, it's just surprise. I'm ready.
Press the record button and we go, okay, we have the theme from the last conversation and we see where it takes us. And so we're just going to stay curious and wonder our way through this. One of my favorite quotes, Carl Jung, he said, unless we make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. I want to hear your take on this. I have no idea what your response is going to be. I have some guesses, but for me, so much of my own growth as a person, as a human, as a leader, an entrepreneur, as your husband, as a dad to three kiddos, so much of my growth is connected back to the really hard work. It is not easy. The really hard work of taking all the stuff that I either intentionally bury down in my subconscious because I don't want to deal with it, or the stuff that I work hard to find in my subconscious or unconscious mind and try to bring it to more conscious awareness so that I have agency over those stories, so that I'm able to connect the dots between those stories and the way that I'm showing up in the world, the way I'm communicating, the way I'm hiding, the way I'm playing small, the way my pride can lead me to fail. So many things. And that's hard work. But if I could look back on all of that work and whatever growth I have been able to experience, so much of it goes back to that Carl Jung idea. It's like, gosh, I got to pay attention, grow in self-awareness. And our work at Astoria, we call that growing in narrative intelligence, that I'm trying to become increasingly aware of the stories that I'm telling myself and the narratives that they're rooted in. But that's been a game changer for me. And so I want to talk about that briefly. But what do you think that idea means to you? What comes to mind when we talk about making the unconscious conscious?
Well, if we're going to go with the first thing I think of, I am terrible at recalling quite a bit of my childhood, mm-hmm. which is crazy. I did not have, by all intents and purposes, I did not have a traumatic, quote unquote, childhood. I was raised in an average home in an average city in a below average state, but I don't have a ton that I can pull from. And so when I think about those things and the way that I've probably not processed things that in the right amount of time that I should have, or I misunderstood things in the moment and then just didn't know how to deal with it, was not equipped to really understand what was happening. I learned to deflect. That is my natural state, is I don't want to deal with this. I don't have the emotional capacity to deal with this, so I will just deflect it. And in doing that, all of the things that I then participated in, or the path that it kind of set me on to getting to when I, honestly, when I met you and I was like, cool, welcome to my life. I'm broken and I don't know how to fix that. And I think in the context of the quote, one, fate is a terrible writer of stories, but to not allow myself to maintain the agency that I should have in order to choose the path I wanted. At almost 41, I am still figuring that out because I had to unravel so much. So it's hard to not want to go backwards and go, well, what would have happened had I just dealt with that thing? Or what would have happened if I had just stuck up for myself? What are the choices that I would have made that would have been different? And where would I have landed? Would I have still met you? And there's, you can would and should and could all day long. But I think you and I both want for our three kids to not have them choose those same things. We ask a lot of hard questions of them. We are pulling and pulling and excavating constantly, going, hey, this is a safe place for you to speak things. I think I said to Everly recently, I was like, you can tell me something that's really hard for me to hear. You can say something that might even sound mean because I can handle that, but you can't handle holding on to it. So I need you to be honest with me. I never heard those words as a kid. Yeah. It was like, oh.
Yeah. I think in my house, it was like, oh no, feelings, feelings. There's some people have feelings and we don't know how
to. We out.
And it was just, yeah, it's like somehow we went from feeling nothing to lots of yelling and throwing things. Like that escalated very quickly.
Hey, I grew up in a Scandinavian family with a lot of distance from our emotional selves and a lot of attitude to boot. Yeah. So dealing with, like, quote unquote, dealing with things was, hey, we're going to yell at each other and scream about it until we just can't even yell anymore.
Yeah.
And then by the time we're done, we don't even know what we were yelling about.
Yeah.
And no one even feels better. And then the next time you try to hide it just a little bit more so that you don't have to do that again. Mm-hmm. Cause let's be honest, that's kind of what the first few years of our marriage were like.
I something else I've been thinking about lately on this subject is, I don't think I ever talked about this before. I've been really hard on especially my dad, like publicly hard on my dad. You know, I spent a lot of my 20s trying to earn the approval of so much of the world around me, only to then make the unconscious conscious and realize, holy crap, this is all me trying to get my dad to say, hey, son, I'm probably proud of you. Like, you're finally enough, right? You finally measured up to my expectations. And then once I realized that, I spent a lot of my 30s, for anybody who's heard me speak, a lot of times I've been transparent about my relationship with my dad. If you read my book, I told the story about my dad. If you saw him, there's a documentary made years ago called Counterfeit. It was pretty hard on my dad. And while simultaneously being hard, I've also tried to balance that with the very obvious and evident love that my dad has had for me. And despite our relationship being complicated, it's also, like, it's genuinely good. Like, we talk, we hang out, we laugh together, and sure, it's not perfect and there are days I wish it was deeper, but like we're good. We're totally okay. It's not like I'm estranged, right?
No.
our family's close. Like, they live close now. We hang out at each other's houses. Our kids spend the night at their house. But when I think about the conversation I had with Jackie and how so often there's this trauma that then gets passed down, the lingering effects gets passed down from generation to generation. We have a mutual friend who always says, look at what's in someone's upstream, right? When I look at what's in my dad's upstream, my real grandfather, who I have a vague memory of meeting very briefly when I was a little kid, but I never really knew. I have no connection or understanding of who he was. I share his name. I'm literally a third, and I share this man's name. And I look at my relationship with my dad and the way that my dad struggled to communicate love, despite now looking back, knowing that it was actually there. And I'm like, gosh, I now look at it with so much more grace and understanding. So I'm like, gosh, if you're getting beat up all the time when you're a kid, because your dad is an alcoholic and is throwing things, and you're seeing your mom, she's constantly trying to protect you and take care of you. You're seeing her get drug around the house by her hair, her clothes, beat up all the time. You're trying to take care of your little brother. Gosh, like in that context, I can't believe how amazing my dad was at being a dad, right? And I think we both have that in our stories. Both of us have struggled back with our fathers, and yet both of our fathers didn't really have a clear picture of what a healthy dad looked like.
Crazy enough, only just now in this moment am I realizing that both of our fathers are firstborn sons. I don't know why that's never even dawned on me. My dad's dad, my grandfather, who I loved dearly, he passed away a few years ago, was an alcoholic for many years. He was not an abuser, but he was an alcoholic. And our family worked to mask that with humor. Oh, we keep non-alcoholic beer in the fridge for family things, but also everyone's going to drink wine and we're going to do this. And we're just going to kind of ignore the fact that there's a man here who would keep his kids in the car while he would go to the bar. Like his young children, 4 or 5 years old, sitting in the car while he would go get hammered. And the humor part of it never was funny. And even as a kid, I knew that. So it's so fascinating to think about because we don't talk about it. My parents aren't drinkers and they're great, wonderful people. But yeah, when we got married, there were a lot of things that you and I brought to the table that we went, man, some of the stuff in our family's history is really heavy. Do we want to continue? Do we want to continue this?
I don't think we, because again, we had not made the unconscious conscious. No. I don't think we knew the way that it was leading us to show up in the world and communicate with each other in a certain way and connect with each other or not connect with each other in a certain way. There's just, it's there. It's imprinted on you, passed down from generation to generation and still not dealt with.
And it's interesting, if I were really to sit down and look back, I can be incredibly critical and point out all of the faults. Here's how all of the things were that you came up short. You didn't do this. You didn't do this. You didn't do this. You didn't give me this. But the man who was my father is light years different than his own dad.
Same.
And like that gets me emotional because I deeply care about my dad. But knowing that he did the best that he could with the abilities he had, he showed up. And you know, honestly, as an adult, we have a much better relationship as adults because my dad is such a logical human. And so I'm like, okay, we can connect on things like golf and sporting events and our children and the fact that you are, you know, having a sleepover with my 5-year-old and being the most hilarious human ever. I wouldn't trade that.
Yeah.
And I'm going, man, the fact that something clicked, something happened, and my kids get to have the relationship almost that I wish I would have.
Yeah.
I'm happy. I'm so thrilled for them to get to experience that man.
Yeah. This is not where I thought we would go this quickly.
Same.
I'm glad we did. But this trauma that we speak of, one of the things I do want to kind of get into is, I think there's an upside, as I was kind of asking Jackie at the beginning of last week's episode. The good thing is that we are, like, everyone truly is becoming more trauma-informed. We're understanding how these life experiences that we have impact the way that we function, the way that we show up, the stories we tell ourselves. And we're becoming slightly less judgy of others. We're becoming more aware of that upstream, so to speak. But the obvious risk in that, when there's so many influencers talking about trauma, is that we start overusing words like trauma and then people start self-diagnosing, right?
That, yes.
And I think that's where we start to get ourselves in trouble. And what's crazy is you and I have had experiences of people who even licensed therapists, not Jackie, she seems incredibly healthy and a special human being, but crazy definitions of trauma being thrown around. One that we heard years ago from a therapist that we know is that trauma is anything less than affirming and nurturing. That is
a wide.
I mean, like, everything.
That is Grand Canyon wide gap. that is that that is almost an anything goes. Yeah. Anything that you have experienced in your life, that's trauma. You couldn't find a card at Walmart, trauma. We joke about it, but literally if you were to break down the definition, it's that.
Yeah. But when I first started going down the rabbit hole of this world of research around trauma and where it's stored in the brain and how it's stored in our bodies.
Yeah.
You know, when you hear something like that, you're so new and fresh to the idea, and you're just like, oh, okay, wow, like that's a lot. That's like almost everything. And then, you know, you get a few years into this and you're like, okay, hold on a second. My son just came up to me and was like, Dad, I don't feel good. I can't go to school today because I'm so sick. And I'm like, dude, no. Like, we have great kids. Please don't get the wrong idea about our kids. But that 10-year-old little joker cannot be.
They're little chasers. They know how to work the system, and it's
you and I both. We both know that was that this morning. That was just this morning.
That was this morning, and I knew it. I could hear him coming up the stairs, and it was, and I was like, "Oh, here! Oh, he's going to come up. Sell it now. Oscar goes to."
yeah. And so that may not even be the best example. It's just the most recent example. But I think parents who affirm every single thing that their child feels or experiences as true or good, I just think that's going to create a world of monsters. we have another mutual friend, Andrea Mata, another licensed therapist who seems amazing from
Dr. Mata.
Dr. Mata, Dr. Dre, Andrea.
Dr. Dre, yes, which is my favorite.
She kind of has a beef with the gentle parenting movement, which I love.
And I both.
You know, she confesses, like, I think it started with good, healthy motives. The problem is along the way, gentle parenting actually became closer to what she would refer to as permissive parenting. And she's got these crazy stories of, like, one story I heard her tell one time was someone, she was giving a talk on something, I can't remember what it was, and this kid came up to her and put her hand or his hand on her chest. And then when she looked down, the kid did the little bloop, like gotcha thing up her nose, I think was the story.
Yep.
And she's like, I'm sorry, like, please don't put your hands on me. Go back and sit down. Long story short, not trying to over-dramatize it, but she gets a phone call because probably some parent called the school. It was like, you can't tell my kids like what to do. And I'm like, a teenage boy put his hands on me, like put his finger on my chest and tried to do a little trick thing with my, it's like, no, that's not okay. And it's like, oh, we're trying to create space for these kids to be able to express themselves. I promise I won't go to too many of these stories, but I have another friend who was a professional magician. He lives in Chicago, and he told me a story one time about he was performing at this one particular type of school. I won't name the type of school because I think it's a wide range where some are really good and some of them are just happen to be crazy, right? But he's doing a magic show, and one of the things they teach us starting out in magic, if we do a lot of children's entertainment, if there's not a stage, a stage has a very natural divider line. Like, there's a psychological barrier because it's harder for a kid psychologically to just go, I think it's okay for me to just go up there on that stage. And so a lot of times if you're performing like in a gym or a living room for a birthday party, however you're entertaining a group of children, you need that barrier. And so he always had a rope. He would lay this rope down on the floor and it just kind of created a stage area, even though there wasn't a platform. And the leader of the school comes up to him and is like, hey, what's up with this rope? And he's like, oh, it's just kind of there as like a mental barrier for the kids. That way they know this is my space and that's their space. And that way they're not coming up. And she was like, no, that won't work here. He's like, well, you know, otherwise they come up and they might mess with some of the props for the magic show. And she was like, well, that should be expected. Like, if the kids here want to come up and explore and pick up your props and have a sensory experience with them and touch them and get to familiar, like, that should be okay. We got to give them space to explore that level of curiosity. Now, look, I'm like the wonder guy, right? I love curiosity. And there is so much science in support of being as wide awake to wonder and curiosity as you possibly can be. But that's not okay. It's not okay.
No, because no one would allow a group of kids into NASA's hub place where they've got everything and then go, you know what? Just let them touch whatever. They're going to be fine.
Yeah. Well, they
would, no one would do that because they'd be like, ooh, rockets.
They would say, well, that's not safe. And so that's not a fair comparison. That's apples and oranges. The problem is later on, they're not going to have the understanding and they're going to lose their mind when all of a sudden, for the first time in their life as an adult, there's a boundary put in place, right? And I think that that's the big idea. And I think that's Dr. Dre. Andrea's point is like, hey, high expectations are really healthy for kids, but obviously high expectations within the context of what she calls the warm and fuzzies, right? And so I think that's what we're trying to do with our kids. How can we expect a lot out of our kids, which means we're not going to affirm every single thing, every single idea. We can affirm, hey, cool. Like, we're going to honor and create space for the way that you feel right now. But just because you feel that way doesn't get to inform the wisdom of making the right choice in this moment. I actually said that at least 10 times between the time we left our house and the time I dropped them off at school this morning. I was like, hey guys, we're the Harris family and we do hard things in this family. And I know sometimes it feels like we have high expectations for you guys. But you're amazing kids. You're strong and brave and courageous and capable. We're the Harrises. We do hard things. It's like, fine, right? Jude, who is 10, has his hood on and like, oh my gosh.
Well, he was next level.
The window and it's rainy outside.
So much shade. He threw it at me before we left. He was like, Mom.
All this to say, this is not a parenting episode.
No, but if you
were having a parenting episode, maybe that's what was happening, but this podcast episode is not a parenting episode.
No, it works with leadership.
Yeah.
So Andrea and I actually talked about this. It was setting very clear fence posts and having a lot of freedom inside those fence posts. Mm-hmm. And that concept, whether you are leading a family or you are leading a team, it looks the same. Your team has to know where the boundaries are, and they have to be comfortable knowing that there is a ton of freedom inside those boundaries to make their own decisions, to make the call, to feel confident in the calls that they're about to make or the work that they're about to do. It works for our kids. Hey, here's the very clear fence post. We don't do this. We don't do this. We don't do this, but we do this, 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 and this. And we want you to feel like you can make that call in real time. Mm-hmm. In order to figure it out. There's a lot of space here. As long as you're not hurting people, as long as you're not digging a grave outside, like, we can do hard things. Yes.
Yeah.
But they have to be within the they have to be within limitations.
Yeah. Okay. So perhaps trauma is not anything that you experience that is just short of affirming. And I know that word has a lot of baggage associated with it in 2024, but from the grand scheme of thing, the original intent of the word affirm, it's like, cool, I'm going to create space for my kid to process their emotions, but I'm not going to let it rule the day. We can do hard things. And just because something is a struggle doesn't mean that you have been traumatized. Right? Not everything is trauma. So what is the actual definition of trauma? Well, I asked Jackie that question. And so just to bring that back to the forefront, as you and I are talking about it, she said that trauma is when we get stuck into a state and it's not easy for us to be able to come back and regulate ourselves, right? That experience we have where all of a sudden the story doesn't compute. There's something broken and all of a sudden we feel like we're no longer in control because we can't regulate our emotions. And if that trauma gets lodged in our limbic system, it essentially stays active. And then any experience we have that is reminiscent of that story, our brain freaks out going, oh no, that thing's happening again. Our body and our nervous system freaks out. And all of a sudden it's like, I don't want that thing to happen again. I got to stay safe. Mm-hmm. Dysregulation occurs. Our emotions are all over the place and it's hard. It's hard to cope. So based on that definition of trauma, I would say, sure, the majority of people in the world have probably experienced some trauma, even if not everything hard you experience is trauma.
Yes, I would argue that every person has experienced trauma. Yeah. Some of it doesn't look like what you're thinking in your head. Some of it is systematic. And so it is flying just under the radar and you miss it, but enough of that stacked up is the thing that causes the break.
I have also had more than one therapist, aka a trauma expert, lead me to borderline, if not actual trauma, but those are stories for another day.
I was about to say, I'm pretty sure every therapist I have ever seen, I have left in worse shape. Then you go and see somebody for 45 minutes or 55 minutes, and by the time you've actually gotten somewhere, you're 54 minutes in.
Yeah.
And they're like, cool, time's up. I know you're in a complete meltdown right now, but I have another client and they're here waiting. I can't deal with this. And you're like, cool, I feel terrible.
Well, I think that's why we're seeing such a huge movement towards experiential therapy, which I would put Jackie in the category of, which is why I want to get to the kind of work that she does here in just a moment. Yeah. But like experiential therapy oftentimes isn't, hey, come sit on this couch and let's talk for an hour. Because if trauma is a full body experience and trauma is stored in your body, you can't heal the thing in your body by just sitting on a couch and talking about it. Like, we've got to do the work. And so
you can cope with it, but you can't heal from it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And if the goal is to heal and not cope, it's like, maybe I should actually deal with the real problem. And maybe that might take more than an hour. Maybe I should get off the couch and go do something with my body. Which is why, whether it's working with horses or a lot of work, people doing like body work, somatic stuff like yoga, art therapy, psychodrama, really cool stuff. It's actually moving the needle on people's healing.
Yeah.
In an industry that's obsessed with helping people seemingly cope by like, hey, let's just talk. It's like, okay, let's maybe not talk. Let's do the work and heal. And so I would put Jackie in that category. I think the work she's doing is incredible. Primarily, probably closest to what I would define as art therapy, right? But how can she help people heal by helping people write poems? How does that work?
I want to speak to this as a writer. One, I don't write poetry. I want to be so clear on that. I do not write poetry. Jackie is brilliant. She spits these things out so insanely fast. And she and I actually have a lot of conversations about it. I'm just like, where does this come from? She's like, it's deep inside of us. It's all the things we're already feeling. Mm-hmm. But as a writer, I know that when I sit down at my computer and I put my headphones in and I turn everything off, it's like the world just disappears for however long I allow it to. And I allow my brain to go where it needs to go. And I, a lot of times, will write a lot of one lines. And if you look at my screen, it's just line, 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 line. And then it's like something hits. And then I get whatever it is that I needed to write. Because it's like we need to get out of our own way and out of our own head. It's like you got to remove this thing. I coach our clients a lot on Julia Cameron, The Artist Way, on her morning pages, which is a pretty widely accepted concept. And if you're not familiar with it, Julia Cameron, The Artist's Way, she does a practice called morning pages. And with morning pages, you write down everything you think the moment you wake up. And she's like, it could be the most insane things. You could be like, I had a terrible dream. I really have to pee. I really do need to go to the grocery store. Did the dog go out? But the practice is get it all out first to make space for the things that you need. Get it all out so that you can be much more aware with all of the things that are bouncing around in your head. It just helps clarify. It helps focus. And it's one of the beautiful things about writing is that it is a deeply emotional thing if you allow it to be. And I think music is similar. Who is it? John Mayer has a line in a song that says, someone else's heartbreak becomes your favorite song. Mm. And I think that's such a poetic way. I'm going to use the word poetry. It's such a poetic way to say someone else's pain, you resonated with. That resonated with you. And it became this anthem for you because you saw yourself in it. Mm-hmm. And really, that's the power of words. It's the power of language. It's the power of allowing ourselves to feel those deep things. Our words are those byproducts of those feelings on the inside.
Yeah. I remember when I asked her about this, here's a quote she said. She said, the true essence of poetry, it's in the noticing and the reframing. It's almost like it acts as a prism.
Of course, she said it beautifully too.
Yeah, yeah. She talks about how, you know, when trauma is active and we haven't done the work to heal from it, it sort of kills our creativity. And so allowing yourself to play is really essential to that healing process. It's like you have to learn again that it's okay to express yourself and be creative and play. And writing poetry makes that a little bit easier, not quite as much of an uphill battle because you're using metaphor. And I think about this with our kids all the time, especially our middle kid. You know, she is incredibly creative and has struggled. She's gone through some hard stuff lately.
She's a big empath.
Yeah. And yet it's been really cool. Like if you try to sit down and talk to her, it's like, she doesn't really want to talk about it. She doesn't really want to open up. But you get her drawing, coloring. She's working on clay stuff right now, clay creations. It's like she just comes to life. And all of a sudden, it's like you can see that part of her prefrontal cortex. It just shuts off and stops trying to protect her. And she's just in flow. And she's like, what do you want to talk about? And she's like a wide open book. And all of our kids do that. And I notice it's because adults do that too. It's like we've got to get back to that sense of play. And so whether it's writing poetry or something else, it's finding the thing that's a metaphor. I think about Lego Serious Play. We've got to get a guest on the podcast who's good at Lego Serious Play.
We know some good ones. We know some really good ones.
But same kind of thing. It's like you're asking, we've been in retreats where we've asked some clients that we're coaching. It's like they just can't compute. They're not opening up. They're not sure where that limiting thought or belief is coming from. It's like, hey guys, let's all gather on the table and play with some Legos. You start doing, facilitating some Lego Serious Play. And then all of a sudden they're just like, I never realized that I do that. I guess I believe this. And then all of a sudden this, like all that stuff comes to the surface. They have clarity on it. And again, it goes back to that idea that we started with. All of a sudden the stuff that was unconscious, it starts becoming conscious. And all of a sudden you see them take back the agency and go, well, now that I'm aware of the narrative, I have the power to change it. And I think Jackie is helping people do that beautifully, beautifully.
100% agree.
Yeah. All right. I'd be remiss if I didn't just highlight some more of the work that she's doing. I know if you haven't listened to the episode, go back and listen to it. She is lovely. And she's just really fun to listen to.
She's British.
An accent and her poetry.
She was probably drinking tea with her pinky up.
It's like,
well, she did it.
Like balm. It's like balm for your soul, for your heart.
It really is.
I know. We've got to spend a lot of time with her lately. We hosted a 3-day intensive called the Poetics Intensive. She did some poetry for that. She was just at the Story Summit we just wrapped up, and she did some poetry at that. And then I got to have her here on the Wild of a Life podcast. So we've had lots of Jackie lately, and we're here for all of it.
And her book sits on our bookshelf.
Yeah.
Stop the World, I Want to Get Off.
That's a great title. But she's created this program, for lack of a better words, to support family members of those who are struggling with addiction. And I think I didn't realize until I talked to her that there wasn't a space for those folks, right? I guess technically, like that could have been me as a kid, surrounded by people struggling with addiction. I guess it's me now because you're addicted to Instagram and I have to live in the same house with you.
I am most definitely not addicted to Instagram.
Your addiction to LinkedIn and I have to live
in the same house with you. I do love LinkedIn. I
never thought I would say that out loud.
Oh, I'm such a nerd.
My wife is addicted to LinkedIn. Those are not words.
I am addicted to competition.
That was not on the bingo card. Competition was on the bingo card.
Competition's not always LinkedIn. On the bingo card.
Yeah. But the reality is that's just about all of us, right? If you say the word addiction, we go to the stereotypical stuff, drugs, alcohol.
We think of intervention. We're like, oh, well, I wasn't on intervention.
Yes.
So I'm okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't on intervention. Sure, I scroll my social media feed a little too much. I can't put my phone down, but like, I'm not as bad as he is, right? And I think that's the danger. And so, you know, Jackie has this expertise in social media addiction, and it was fascinating to be reminded of all the research about, like, the networks are literally designed for addiction. You know, one of the things they measure most is time spent on platform. It's literally called time spent on platform. They don't want you to leave, right? Because then they don't get as many advertising dollars. They want you to scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll. And so I think we got to take this idea of addiction very seriously and not just assume, oh, well, that thing that she is doing is for people who grew up in a house where their father was an alcoholic.
No, here's the thing that's crazy. Every addict, regardless of their vice, will begin to change things very small about themselves in order to fuel that addiction. So if you are an alcoholic, you start to hide the alcohol. If you are a drug addict, you hide the drugs. If I'm on LinkedIn and I am, or Instagram, I start changing things about myself. I start highlighting the things that are really good, or the things I very specifically want to see, or I add that filter. Or LinkedIn says post at 6:30 a.m. Cool, I'm going to do that. And I'm also not going to include the link, and I'm not going to do all the things that it says not to do, because I actually want people to read this thing. And if I don't do that, well, then that's the spiral. The spiral is, what do I have to change about myself and everything around me in order to, quote unquote, optimize my life to make room for this thing that I care about deeply?
Yeah.
And that's the danger in it. Yeah. So if you think that, oh, well, I'm not a drug addict. I'm not an alcoholic. We all have something. Addiction to approval, addiction to stepping on the scale every day and watching that number go down, addiction to how many calories you eat, or how many cups of water you drink, or how many likes you get on a post. Those are addictions. And what's crazy is that the people of Silicon Valley don't even allow their own kids to have social media because they already know.
Yeah. Is now an appropriate time to talk about your caffeine addiction?
I 100% have a caffeine addiction that I don't want to talk about.
I'm joining Jackie's program.
Nope.
Jackie, nope. I need support. Help me cope with learning how to live in a home with someone who is struggling with addiction.
No, I can quit anytime. That's what everyone says. I can quit anytime. No, that caffeine addiction is really for your benefit and not even as much mine. Let's just be really clear.
Oh, so funny.
Hey, but I have had addictions in the past.
Yeah.
And I have addictions now. Sure, not Instagram, but I am addicted to wanting people to see me a certain way, and I'm wanting to control everything. So is that something I'm working on constantly?
Yeah.
Constantly.
Well, Jackie said, if we twist it around and go, what purpose is this serving and how can we stop that being the go-to, then so much change is possible. And I think that's really what, that'd be a great place to sort of try to tie this conversation up, is that change is possible. Mm-hmm. And it's possible even in the darkest hour when you feel like there is no more hope. And you and I are walking, living proof of that. Like, theoretically, we should have had horrible dads. And sure, you and I both talked openly about the reality that we have imperfect dads, and I am an imperfect dad. But like, we should have had horrible dads who had no idea what they were doing. And yet, both of us have fathers who quite literally changed their family tree.
Yes, they did.
And so I would imagine, despite the feelings of hopelessness and despair when they're little kids and they're having these dark moments, whether it was your dad being left alone in the car, not knowing how many hours is going to be stuck there, whether it was my dad getting beat up or watching his mom get beat up in an abusive home with an alcoholic dad, like, it's kind of miraculous that you and I are here married to each other with the kind of kids that we have, living the life that we have with this level of commitment to each other and a willingness to do the work, right? And that's not me trying to like brag on us and toot our own horn. It's just proof that the change is possible. The change is possible. But perhaps it might start by wondering, what don't I know that my brain knows? What's buried deep down and being stored in my body that I'm not walking around conscious of day in and day out? And so whether it's through working with an experiential therapist, someone who's truly qualified and healthy, a great therapist, because there's so many unhealthy ones out there, or a great coach who, yeah, is trauma-informed, even though that word is being thrown around. What we probably shouldn't do is scroll our Instagram feeds listening to influencers who are armchair psychologists, just trying to validate anything and everything that we think and feel, and then anything that's not that, calling it trauma. So friends, do the work. Do the work. Kate, babe, as we started at the beginning of this episode. Babe, any final thoughts you want to leave folks with before we wrap this one up?
No, this is such a deep subject, and there's no way in 45 minutes that we can even scratch a fraction of the surface. But the biggest thing I would hope that people take away from this is that just because it was doesn't mean it has to be. Mm-hmm. You get to choose your next. You get to choose your story. You get to choose every little aspect of it. And fate is not who you want in the driver's seat. And I hope that people hear this and maybe one, and I could probably learn from this, give my parents a little bit of grace and see them for the people that they had to become to do what they did.
Yeah.
And I hope that someday my kids can do the same for me.
Amen to that. What a great convo. I'm so glad we wing these things. Good stuff comes out.
Wing it.
Winging it.
You know what we should start doing? I'm winging it with wings.
We should.
We should.
Will they be as spicy as the ones your little sister ate a few months ago?
I had one and my face melted off.
They cried. And
I think I cried.
Brutal.
It was
brutal.
It was so brutal.
All right, friends, that is it for this episode. If you find yourself right now thinking, that was a weird conversation for a podcast called The Wow Level Life. Listen, these are the kind of conversations that must be had in order to live a wow level life. We've got to go deep. We've got to do the work. And ultimately, wonder plays a very serious role in that. Wonder feels so flippant and optional and like, yeah, I'd love to feel a sense of childlike wonder every now and then. But remember, what the science is teaching us is that these positive awe states, these wonder states, that is the only state in which we are open to the curiosity of a new story being more true than the one that we're already telling ourselves. So I would venture to say, if you look at an understanding of trauma and all the latest research on that, and an understanding of awe and wonder and all the latest research of that, it's going to be pretty hard to heal trauma without getting a lot more curious. And we can't get a lot more curious without a whole lot more wonder, since curiosity is just simply wonder in action. So make space for wonder. Pay attention to how you're using your imagination. We don't want to misuse it on worry and fear, and especially irrational fear. And so we've got to do this work. Wonder has a place in this conversation. And I think if we can allow it to play its role in the conversation, we can all live wow level lives together. All right. I'm Harris. This has been Kate. We'll talk to you next week.